remnants of the Nazi government, and in accordance with that assignment, I went almost immediately to county headquarters for the Nazi Party in Reutte, which was lodged in one of the main buildings on the main street. As you can imagine, the town had just been, in the case of Austria, liberated, in the case of Germany, taken, I suppose. And there were hordes of displaced persons who had suddenly become at liberty, who were wandering around, some of them drunk, some of them looting, some of them just enjoying themselves. When I went to the party headquarters, I was amazed because, in contrast to every other party headquarters which I had visited, this one was still completely intact. In other words, typically, before evacuating an area, the party officials would take everything out and destroy it, burn it, so that it wouldn't fall into American or Allied hands. The typical scene would be that you would walk in, find possibly a picture of Hitler on the wall and a bunch of empty file cabinets and a few beat up pieces of furniture. This headquarters had, as far as I could tell, not been touched. The files were intact. The equipment was all there. It looked as though the occupants had left it as they had a matter of a very few hours before. Down in the basement, there was a huge cache of arms of all sorts. Rifles, submachine guns, Panzerfaust, grenades, ammunition. And in the typical Austrian architectural style, it had this sort of beehive construction to the cellar, so that it looked like a typical candidate for a German Ratskeller, if they were ever so inclined. But through these arches, the entire basement was filled with guns and ammunition. In the top floor, there were a number of pieces of equipment, some of which could be identified as WT sets. I assume you know what they are. Shortwave transmission sets, which could be used either between military units or conceivably by any group that wished to carry on underground activity or resistance. As I was going through the records and going through the file cabinets, these drunken displaced persons kept coming in the door looking for things to loot. And so I'd have to haul out my pistol, point it at them, and order them out of the building. But unfortunately, it had more than one entrance. And I would order them out the front door, and then more of them would be coming in the back door. And when they would come into a room, they would look for anything they could put their hands on. There may have been liquor in the building, I don't know. And pull out files and scatter them on the floor, and it would be extremely difficult to reconstitute them on our part to make heads and tails of them. At this point, I gave up, walked out of the building, and went up to get a couple of soldiers from the command post to put them on the building to keep the displaced persons out. And asked a couple of Americans had also wandered in, and we're looking at the signal equipment that was there. As I was going up the street to the command post, I was flattened against the wall by a horrible explosion and turned around to see that the building was exploding.
The very building just went.
Right, yeah. And stuff was coming out of the windows, and the ammunition in the basement was going off seriatim. I watched this. Fortunately, some of the people, when the building exploded, were blown out against windows, and so they were blown into the street. Unfortunately, some of them were blown against the wall, and they never did get out, I don't believe. I suppose we'll never know who was in and who was out, because nobody kept any track of anything at that juncture. As we later learned, the housekeeper in the building lived in a wing which did not go up. She had at first been utterly uncommunicative as to the whereabouts of the leader. She finally, when she had to be rescued, as she did, she couldn't tell us fast enough that it must have been done by the leader, but unfortunately the leader had not informed him of the existence of this time bomb that he'd set, presumably in the chimney of the building and hooked into the ammunition depot in the basement. So she told us where he had a cabin or a country house in the mountains. When we could, we followed through to locate this man. I can't remember his name anymore. But in the tradition of the God of Demerung, he had killed his four children and his wife and then lit their bodies afire with a mattress and then shot himself. So that stands out, that incident very clearly on the von Braun subject. I might add that many people who were prominent in the German government had gone to the Austrian Tyrol in the hopes that this would be the last redoubt and that some sort of defense could be made there in reliance upon what Hitler had always promised were his secret weapons, which he would produce, which would end the war favorably to Germany. Much of the time was spent collecting. Are you familiar with the RSHA?
No.
RSHA stands for Reichssicherheitshauptamt, which was the central administrative offices for the SS. And subdivided were these offices were in seven offices called Amts. Amt 1 was personnel. Amt 2 was finance. I believe Amt 3 was your internal secret intelligence, various sources of information that they had throughout Germany. Amt 4, I believe, was Gestapo. Amt 5, I can't remember. Amt 6 was foreign secret intelligence, and Amt 7 was research. Amt 2, the finance division, was in this Reuter area. And so we spent quite a lot of time picking these people up because the finance records, of course, were indicative of the inner workings of the RSHA. I think we practically reconstituted the whole office at one point, and these people were, although officially hardcore Nazis, basically they were essentially finance people and finance oriented, and not nearly the firebrands that you might find in other aspects of the Nazi administration. It was also interesting from the point of view of finally meeting up with people who were our counterparts in the German army throughout the war. Some of whom we knew of by name and activity, and I particularly remember a Major Lind, who, Lind, L-I-N-D, who was active across from us in the 7th Army in the Alsace-Lorraine area during the winter campaign there. And he had ended up in this area. And we had caught a number of the agents that he had trained and sent over through the lines, short term, short range, and with limited expertise, I would say. In some aspects, the Germans thought, presumably with some degree of success, if they could saturate the opposition with enough of their agents, the Foreign Intelligence Service would be kept busy picking up garbage and stay away from the good stuff, I suppose. And there were a number of people in the Major Lind unit that we picked up at various farmsteads around Reuter. And it was fascinating to talk with them. Understandably, they were somewhat reluctant to give us all of the details of all of their activities, because I think they were afraid we'd take it out of their hides, which they really didn't have to worry about at that juncture. The war, for all practical purposes, is practically over at that point. Our particular division was stationed around the area of Three Kreiser, Reuter, Imst, and Landeck. And I, at various times, stayed in all three county seats. But initially, at least, my first station was Reuter, which
what
is...
What did you say in Reuter, do you remember?
At first, we stayed in this house on the main street of town, which was not that far away from the headquarters that I've just described. It was either up the street or down the street, but in any event, on the same street. At a later point, we moved outside of town, somewhat removed from the town, and I can no longer remember that building particularly. Perhaps for security purposes, I can no longer recall why we moved or what the circumstances were.
How long, do you remember when you first moved into town? Do you keep those dates in your mind?
No. Sometime in April.
I can probably set it back as long as you do.
That was it. Yeah, whatever that
you
was.
Right with the front troop?
Just about,
just
yeah.
About, you know, a day behind or something like that?
No, a matter of...
Hours?
Yeah, it was a couple hours after the first tanks would go through, we'd be there. It was sort of a column, and at that point the resistance against us was sporadic and limited, and so our column would go right along behind the tanks.
You had no idea that there was a group of scientists and engineers there?
No. Had no information on this whatsoever.
How many days after you got there did you become aware that they were there? Could you tell us the circumstances leading to this?
Yes.
And ultimately,
I can't tell you the number of days that passed before this happened. I would suspect that it was a very short time after we arrived.
Mm-hmm.
As you can imagine, the events in those days were so hectic. I was going on 4 and 5 hours sleep a night or less, and we were working very hard. And so it all sort of kaleidoscoped together,
right.
And I may make mistakes as a result.
Well, what were the circumstances that led to your picture being taken?
Yes, the first information we had as to the identity and the background of these scientists was that Magnus von Braun, Werner von Braun's younger brother, came through the line from the German side and was brought to our office.
Do you remember where he was actually made contact?
No.
But somewhere near Reuter.
Somewhere near Reuter.
He came into your office in Reuter.
And he came into our office in Reuter.
We located a corporal that was, I forgot his name, but he lived in Sheboygan, Michigan.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we tracked him down. We'll be seeing him one of these days.
I see. Yeah. And he is the one who first met Magnus?
The man saw him coming over the crest of the hill.
I'll be guide. I can, at that... Our first meeting with him was in our office, and I was very impressed with him, first of all.
He was brought into your office by whom? Do you remember? I mean, it was
no.
Rupert. He just came into your office. You,
yes.
Were you expecting to see him?
No.
So he's just sitting in your office like you are today, and all of a sudden somebody knocked on the door and said, here's Magnus von Braun.
Just about, Just about like that.
Okay.
He was a very impressive fellow. He spoke fluent English. He's highly articulate and obviously very intelligent. He explained that he was with his brother, who was the chief scientist among a group of scientists who were responsible for both the invention of and operation of the V-2 and V-1 rockets, which had had such devastating effect on England and during the war. There were some 100 or 150 of them, I believe, all together. They were principally at an inn, and I can no longer remember the name of the inn, outside of Reuter, and I can't tell you where. And they were very interested in joining forces and coming over and joining the Americans. They were particularly anxious to not await any final outcome of the war, because they had learned that there was some fanatical SS leader in Innsbruck.
That was Kammler.
His name was Kammler? I guess that's right. Yeah, Hans Kammler, who actually planned to carry out some of the more fanatical orders that scientists were to be killed before they fell into Allied hands. And they were afraid he would either come or send out an elimination squad and kill them all. We arranged to go back with Magnus von Braun through our part of the line and in some way set up the exit from the German side. I went back with them partway. No, not far. And they then came through driving their own vehicles. And we had. I believe so.
Where was this picture taken?
I believe that picture was taken right outside of our office.
Do you know who these people are?
No. Oh, Colonel Axter.
No, right here.
No.
Yeah.
No, I can't identify either of those. I knew them at the time.
Yeah.
We did prepare incident reports on this. No, those would not be locals, excuse me. They would be member of the scientific party.
Okay.
And I'm sure that the Germans could identify them.
I'm sure they have been around to ask them who they were.
Yeah.
When you prepared reports on all of this?
Yes, we prepared reports on this.
What happened to these reports? Where they, who they were submitted to?
They would have been submitted to 6th Corps in all probability, or to 7th Army directly.
7th Army directly. And these would be intelligence reports.
These would be intelligence reports.
These theoretically could be on file somewhere.
I assume so. Wherever the government takes all that stuff and files it, or indeed if it is still in existence, I don't know. It might very well have been burned, as many files were. I didn't keep anything except a small notebook. I do have some of my old notes. I don't even know if I could decipher them at this point, but I kept certain notes. I have them here in the office. I could take a look at them if you wanted to see them. I can no longer remember whether any of them tie into this.
No, the photographs.
No, not that I know of. These were taken by an army photographer, I believe.
What did the photograph? Do you remember how it first turned up? Did we turn it up down in Huntsville and turn it to you?
No, I tell you what happened. This fellow, Goodbar. Dick Goodbar, in Counterintelligence Center in Holabird, was given the assignment for some reason of finding out who I was, and went back into the old.
Assignment.
I think you did.
Yeah, that's probably my
Probably through your
intelligence.
I see.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was in the Army originally. That's probably why we wanted to get it tracked down. But I forgot where the picture first turned up.
He then went through the old personnel records, knowing that it was the 44th Division area. That he just, very interesting, as he looked at the picture, he saw that they were listening to me and apparently understanding me, so that they assumed that I spoke German. And they then went into the personnel records to find someone of my height and general description who might have been in the counterintelligence corps, and amazingly enough came up with this.
Did you speak German?
Yes.
Yeah.
They then called my sister in Connecticut, and she gave them my New York address and telephone number, and even paid me a couple of calls. Well, I remember that the photographs were taken at the time, but I...
Were there other photographs taken?
Yes.
Hmm. Wonder where they would be.
Well, I'm not sure.
That's the only one you've ever seen?
That's the only one I've ever seen. Hmm. But now, wait a minute. I'm sorry, I have seen others, and I don't know where. Possibly at the time, photographs were made available of this and other things to us, because there is another photograph showing all of us out in front of our headquarters.
That would be marvelous. Do you have it?
No, I don't think so. If you wish, I'll look into my old notes and see if I possibly have it. But I don't. But at one time, it was in existence at one time. Let's see. They came through in their own vehicles, and I remember Dr. von Braun's vehicle particularly, because it was a very handsome BMW. And he had it rigged up with a number of different gadgets, including a little gadget on the wheel which would enable him to get extra control. And they were a wonderful car anyway. Unfortunately, they don't make them anymore. Very delicate engine with magnificent power. And I might add that since he couldn't take it over the Bailey Bridges because of the low base of the car, he had to leave it behind, and John Ballas and I used it around the local area after he left.
You never photographed that?
I don't think so. Unfortunately, we had to leave it behind in turn because we were finally, 3 months later, sent into Germany and had to leave all but military vehicles behind. But it was a very beautiful car and lovely handling vehicle. The first group out was about four or five, and they consisted of General Dornberger, the military chief of the operation, Dr. Werner von Braun, Magnus von Braun, Colonel Axter, I might add that we've been using Colonel Axter's patent attorney in Germany since. I haven't seen him since the war, but he apparently has gone back to Düsseldorf and is practicing back there. And two or three others, so that would be, let's say, six or seven who came out initially. Right. Since the circumstances of their arrival and indeed, in our opinion, their very great value, didn't make it a particularly good idea to put them in jail or into a compound, we had no other facility. And so we lodged them in the house with us for two or three days or nights.
You were living in the main
street. Yes. No, I'm sorry. By that time,
that
we,
was when you moved, by
that time we had moved, as I recall it. But don't hold me to that, because it sort of melds at this point, you know. But I do remember that we had plenty of room. And They were very open, very frank, and told us, essentially, I'm speaking now of Dr. Von Braun, that what he was really interested in was not so much such petty things as fighting between sovereign states, such as Germany and the United States, but in interplanetary travel. He complained that Hitler had been remarkably stingy in his appropriations to this whole enterprise.
He got $3 billion.
How much?
$3 billion.
Well, for those days and for those times and purposes, that was no small sum. He said that he had the capability of flying to the moon and back, which at this point, 25 years ago, seemed highly fanciful. He explained that not only had he working V-2s that were landing on London, but that he had right on the drawing board and had the capability of dropping these V-2s, making a V-2 which would reach New York without any difficulty whatsoever. This was a further fact that made us all sit up and take notice.
How did you impress you when you first met him?
He was a very remarkable man. He was very open, within reason, and very forthright, obviously brilliant. He also came across as really quite sincere in taking the positions that he took. General Dornberger, I would say, was still the chief of the operation because of his military rank, and indeed, I suppose, out of habit, your scientific crew looked to him sort of for guidance. He was the boss. Because of a carryover, if you will. He was far more of a administrator, politician, I would say, than he was a frontline general. Obviously, with a very strong scientific background.
Yeah,
right. But I assumed that his responsibility was the broader-based administrative one rather than that of a soldier or an engineer. I'm not sure what Magnus von Braun's role was other than being a younger brother of Dr. von Braun. He was also very useful, obviously, because his English was better than anybody else's. And he served to interpret and fill in. The reason they chose the Americans as the most likely people to associate with was that they felt that the Americans would want to and be in a position to supply the necessary funds and means for them to carry out what they envisioned as the future of interplanetary travel.
What did you do after hearing all of this? I mean, were you hearing this alone, or did you have other...
No, other people heard it with me who were in the unit.
Was there anybody else trained to understand this?
No.
No. You were the most highly trained, would you say, of the people?
No, I wouldn't say that. No. Really, none of us, to my knowledge, had any scientific background or indeed any... mission to do anything in this area whatsoever.
But you obviously realize important.
Common sense would dictate this, that
you
do something here.
Here you have some of the world's outstanding engineers and scientists. What do you do now? You've got these in a small town of Roisier in Austria, and the war is going on. What do you do?
Well, we were in no position to follow up or follow through on this. Our only concern was to get them into the hands of people who we hoped would be willing and able to follow through with the whole project.
How'd you go about doing this?
We first called Sixth Corps. I don't recall whether I called myself. I know I was party to some of these conversations with either Sixth Corps or Seventh Army. Whether I made the first call or not, I can no longer recall, because there were a number of calls back and forth. I was very upset that I could not get anybody to appreciate the significance or the importance of these people, or potential importance of these people to us. They'd ask such stupid questions as, well, are they members of the Nazi Party? I also, in looking at my letter to you, I remember they asked me, well, have you given them a thorough screening? And I said, what in hell for? What in hell do you want to screen them for? I mean, and they, of course, had no answer to that. Any party affiliation or other affiliation was, you know, completely beside the point. This went on, and that accounts for the reason why they were there with us for the 2 or 3 days that they were with us. We couldn't get anybody to function. Finally, and I can no longer recall how this was done or who took the effort from 6th Corps or 7th Army, higher headquarters did send down a delegation to pick up, I believe, 6th or 7th of them, including Dr. von Braun, General Dornberger, and all of those who were living in with us, and took them off to wherever 6th Corps was, possibly Houston. At that time, and possibly right on up to 7th Army and higher headquarters.
You don't remember who these people were that came in?
Unfortunately, no. I do remember. I think that they finally sent down transport in the form of trucks, actually, and loaded them all into trucks. I remember being present when they were shipped out, and I remember saying goodbye to them, and...
They didn't all go, just a few of them. Though.
I think all of those who were living with us went. There were obviously, let's say, 140 more either up at the inn or scattered around, who were taken care of later,
right.
I believe, or at least a major portion
right.
of them were taken care of later.
Would this be roughly a week after you first came in contact with them?
No, it would be less than that. It would be a matter than when they came out, let's say, a matter of 3 or 4 days.
Before
they were taken off.
That's the last you saw them.
That's the last I saw them, yeah. I saw nothing for them.
Well, a few reminiscences. You tended to forget about this. Did you just meet von Braun? Did you of your own accord after the war write him or ring him or... With him?
No, I tell you, I did read about him occasionally in the newspaper,
uh-huh.
and read of the V-2 experiments and his work over here in this
mm-hmm.
country. I stayed in Germany after the end of the war
oh.
until about 1948,
oh.
and actually in 1945 my job was civilianized over, and I worked for the War Department for 3 years over there.
What
was it? Worked for a while as an agent in Germany, and then at one point took what was known as the Russian desk for that area, because at that point, almost immediately at the end of the war, the Russians were a serious intelligence problem, and the French to a lesser degree, but the Russians were a serious one. And, it was sort of a hiatus between the demise of OSS and the inauguration of CIA.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, G2 had sort of ragtail intelligence units had to fill in the gap. And so our mission was somewhat expanded at that point. It was still principally counterintelligence,